You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Welcome to another episode of The Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told. And where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to The Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Welcome, welcome, thrice welcome. Let's go for four. Welcome again to Cal McAninch, who is a half man, half Viking from the point of view of also being I Am Spartacus. He's just survived rowing across the Atlantic. And so this is Cal's kindly agreed to come for a second pass or a second row through the clearing to talk about his extraordinary epic quest of rowing in a squad of five, 3,000 miles across the Atlantic as part of the Talisker Whiskey Challenge for Atlantic Body and Soul, which was the name of your boat, I believe. Maybe it wasn't, but that's the charity you were there to row for. So welcome back from your epic quest, Cal McAninch. How are you?
Hello, how are you doing? Just to clarify, our name was Atlantic Body and Soul. We were rowing for two charities, one of which was Body and Soul, which is based in London, but has a reach far beyond that, and The Junction, who are based in Edinburgh. And they both deal with young people's mental health, the Body and Soul dealing with people who've experienced childhood trauma. And The Junction is a drop-in centre for young people in Leith, in North Edinburgh. And they both help young people navigate a way back from suicidal thinking. So it was a great honour and privilege to be able to row across the Atlantic for them.
And you're attaching yourselves to that specific charity. What was the journey and the reason why that was the charity you fixed upon to help?
Well, initially I was part of another crew, and somebody in my other crew, their relative had worked with Body and Soul and had been cared for by Body and Soul, and said they were an amazing charity and that we should speak to them. And we spoke to three charities in total, had meetings with them for an hour long just to talk to them. And Body and Soul, the meeting went so well with them that we had a second meeting, so we did a two-hour chat, and we just felt an instant connection with them. So that's why we chose Body and Soul. And The Junction is just a... we knew people who were connected to The Junction in Edinburgh. They wanted to do something for local people as well.
And it's such a triumphant thing to have achieved. I'm not even sure of the statistics of how few people in the world managed to row across the Atlantic. Did you bother to sort of do that, to compare?
I heard it recently and I've forgotten the number, but it's certainly less than the people who have climbed Everest, for sure. And it is one of those great expeditions that you know, elemental things that people still feel inspired to do or to hear about. And it was just something that fired my imagination, and it wasn't quite what I imagined. I thought it was going to be this communing with nature and lots of wildlife, and whales and dolphins and even sharks. In actual fact, We didn't see any of them. we saw more whales and dolphins up the north of Scotland when we did our training, believe it or not. We thought we were going to be surrounded by them in the Atlantic Ocean, and we saw a million flying fish instead.
Ah, so that was the sort of creature of choice that most showed up, is that right?
Indeed, yeah, and they hit you in the face and they go down your vest and they're all over the place. And we spent so much time, they land on the boat and you then have to rescue them and try and throw them back into the sea again. So we spent a lot of time doing that and cursing flying fish, to be honest.
Okay, so they're not arriving as free supper. You want to get them off the boat as quickly as you
can. Exactly, yeah. And some of them were tiny, so little baby things. So as soon as they're hatched, they must be able to fly. And part of me was thinking, because the day before we finished, I was looking out to sea, and there was about 15 of them all took off at once. It was like a squadron of flying fish. And I had the idea that, you know, because mankind is poisoning the seas as we speak, that all the fish were communicating to each other, that we must evolve, we must grow wings. Let's get out of here, guys, you know, before it's too late.
Yeah, they did it well with feet back in the day.
Exactly, yeah.
So next exactly. It's wings. So flying fish are the new world order, basically.
Exactly, yes.
So we're going to come on to the curated structure as before. I thought it'd be really intriguing to, if I may, not to be too prescriptive, but use the extraordinary expanse of the Atlantic as a metaphor for your clearing, and then for me to just really explore with you how extraordinary a feat it was, but also how it must have changed you, because I can imagine that you were a very different man that set off than the one that arrived, and indeed your squad of five must have had an extraordinary, you know, shared experience, but also you must have gone, I would imagine, the whole gamut of human emotion must have been experienced through the course of the journey.
Pretty much, yes.
So how long have you been back? So how's morale and what's the sort of timeline of when you arrived back?
Been back about 2 weeks. I think I got back 2 weeks today, actually. And since then, the weekend just passed there, Saturday, Sunday, I've been back out with my club, our club, Eastern, again. We're a coastal rowing club. I was coxing on Saturday, then I was rowing on Sunday. And the good news is that my bum feels good at last.
Has recovered. This is a world exclusive. Exactly. Hal McAninch, Scottish actor extraordinaire, his bum has recovered.
Exactly. You don't realise how important that is once I start to tell you.
Yes, and by the way, your good lady, goodly Ms. McAninch, also Shona McDonald, told me about something that you all got very versed on. The thing you need to avoid was trench foot of the arse, if I may say so.
Yeah, well, the first row out of like Omera, I could feel my arse going, and it didn't let up until we actually finished, you know, because the two things you need to heal is to stop rowing and to keep it dry. And it's the two things you can't do. So for six and a half weeks, it just got worse and worse and worse.
And that is, so 6.5 weeks was the epic quest in its sort of inception to completion. That's how long?
Yeah, approximately. Yeah, it was 39 days.
Wow.
39 days, yeah.
And when I saw the most extraordinary film sequence of you arriving back, you were a bearded, majestic, sort of almost like a Ben Gunn. And you all looked fantastic because, you know, obviously you must, I don't know how much lighter you were when you're half the man you arrived back being, I'm sure. So what happened to your weight during the course of the...
We all lose weight, but we were very, one of our crew members, Matt, was very thorough. And he was given the task of sourcing the food and understanding about how much we needed to take in terms of calorie intake. And so he was on, so he's what, 6'3", 6'4". He was on 6,000 calories a day. And wow. I guess I was on about 5,000 a day. So you've got the dry, desiccated food, the expedition food that you had to have. We had two of those a day, plus a pudding, plus... We made our own breakfast, muesli stroke porridge. If you added hot water to it, you could make it into a porridge. But it was full of fruit and nuts and all good things. And also we added nut butter to it and honey and maple syrup to make it absolutely calorie dense. Great way to start the day, you know.
And it's
yes, keep going.
I was going to say, it's not as if there is a sort of luxurious sort of galley where you can prepare your food. This is an extraordinarily small craft, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, so there was five of us on it as well, so about 26, 27 feet. And they made for three or four people, and we had five on it. So it was always problematic, the fact space was problematic. But in terms of food, we also had what were called snack packs as well, because we were told by nutritionists advised us that we had to drink water every 20 minutes to half an hour, but also because we knew that, but we also had to eat every 20 minutes to half an hour. So we had these snack packs, which were usually, I mean, we had dried fruit and things, but we had chocolate covered nuts and chocolate bars and all sorts of things, your whole variety. So there wasn't boring what we were eating. There was always a variety of stuff to eat. And we were pretty good. Matt was very robust when it came to, have you eaten? Da, da, da. Have you drunk? Da, da, da. You know, he was great at that. He was, making sure that we all kept on it, because sometimes we were so tired that it'd be very easy just to go, I'm going to sleep, I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to eat. But no, he kept on us, and we kept up. So
And he was
very,
there
very
also,
important.
and he
Very,
was
very
pulling.
important to keep your nutrition going.
Yes, and he wasn't just there doing the food; he was pulling his weight, obviously, in terms of
Oh
his
yeah,
pounds on,
he's the
pounds
most
off. He was,
powerful. He's the most powerful rower in the boat. Yeah, he was
yeah.
putting every time he put in a shift, it was very. He was using an awful lot of energy, but we had to keep fueled and we had to keep hydrated. Very, very important.
The station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect to your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And even before you set off in the story that you were telling me about the journey to come, even then it was this idea of being 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, relentlessly for the entire epic quest. So I know it's a sort of fairly facetious thing to say, but I've been going to the gym recently, and even rowing for 5 minutes, I thought, phew, that's knackering. So I was just full of respect for just the sheer tenacity. And well, and what was that like? Because you couldn't stop.
Well,
it was relentless.
Well, first of all, we did most crews take 2 or 3 years to prepare for this in terms of raising money, raising profile and training. We did it in less than a year. But in saying that, we had a rowing coach called Gus Barton, who's rowed the Atlantic twice. He's coached many teams to world records. So he would give us a training plan every week, which we would have to, well, we didn't have to follow it. You chose to follow it or not. And he would adapt it depending on, like the guys were working 5 days a week. So depending on what their schedules were like, or my schedule was like, he would adjust it, or you would do what you could.
Yes.
But basically, he was building us up. He was strengthening our core and our movements, and building up the time we spent on the rowing machine, the erg as it's called.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my final row before we left for La Gomera, I was to do 2 hours on the rowing machine. Now, 2 hours on the rowing machine is a lot harder than rowing 2 hours at sea, believe it or not, because you're the rowing machine and quite often just a wall and gym in front of you. So it's mind-numbingly boring. Whereas at sea, you've got everything around you, the beauty and the waves to negotiate and the crew members, and it's much, much easier to do. But my last row, for instance, I rowed 27,000 kilometres, and kilometers, meters. And so I thought I'd just do the 30,000 just to make it, you know, the make up to the 30. And that felt quite okay.
Yes.
Because I'd built it up and built it up and built it up. So then when we went to sea in La Gomera, it was a lot hotter than we'd expected it to be. We were told it was going, the first week would be quite cool. We might need our foul weather gear because there might be storms and things. When we left La Gomera, it was baking hot. And so when you, I rode out first, three of us rode out first, and I went for a break in the cabin, these two tiny cabins. And it was like 40 degrees in the cabin. So you couldn't move in the cabin without pouring with sweat. So that idea that your bum is beginning to get raw from the rowing, I couldn't stop rowing, and you're drenched in sweat. And if you're not drenched in sweat, you're hit by seawater. So you couldn't really keep it dry. So it was a constant battle.
And you painted quite a sort of romantic notional picture of the Atlantic, the sea, the seascape, the wildlife. But what occurred to me was the notion of something like the darkness and then the epicness of the sea. Because obviously you're doing it day in, you know, you're doing it night and day. So I wondered what it was like rowing in the dark of night versus in the daytime and what sort of thought processes you were going through.
The first thing I noticed when we started rowing and we started to get away from land was just the vastness of the ocean, and sounds silly, but the quantity of water. You just become aware of so much water. And it was almost like my brain wouldn't let me experience that without trying to protect me from something. I've been constantly trying to figure out what my brain was doing. But I'd see this huge, vast amount of water. And initially, it was just sort of rolling very gently. So your brain is dealing with the fact it used to be on land and everything's still. And now you're in a space where everything's actually moving. And it looks like a ploughed field. I mean, or a field just beside you as it rolls down and underneath and off and away it goes. But it's actually water and it's moving and there's such a vast amount of it. My brain was, I'd begin to see things like silhouettes of farmhouses and fields and trees and telegraph poles and things, which happened throughout. It didn't stop. It was always like my brain was going, don't worry, everything's okay. Look, it looks like land. And there was even at one point where I saw there was a wave sort of broke and it was white. And half my brain said, there's the sheep. You see, it's land. My other brain went, oh, shut up. It's obviously a wave. And the other brain was going, no, it's a sheep. It's a sheep. Don't worry. It's a sheep. Look, there's farmland. It's okay. It's not just water. You know, so I don't know what was going on. This constant battle with my brain trying to protect me from the fear of not being on land or something. I don't know what it was. Or the fear of the unknown.
Yes. And trying to rationalize and make sense of escape that you've not been at sea for so long ever before. So it's totally unique to your brain as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love
at nighttime, you'd be... it would do the same. It would be like I would see silhouettes of woodland, forests, and it's almost like at nighttime you'd be rowing down this river, which was really, I mean, when it was a full moon, it was absolutely beautiful because you're rowing down like it's an optical illusion, but it's like you're rowing down a river of moonlight. It's quite incredible to see, but when it's darker, you're rowing down this sort of dark river, and on either side always there was trees and fences and all sorts, you know what I mean? It was quite incredible. And never it was always just this vague sense of something. It wasn't like specific trees or anything. It was just a vague sense. And some of the other guys experienced that as well, but I don't know if they experienced farmhouses and
in terms of your sort of mental health and resilience, were you comparing notes with what was going on for you as you went through?
Yeah, to a point. I also began to get hallucinations of people on the boat beside us. And I told a couple of the boys this, and they were quite alarmed because they said, oh, you've got to tell us that because it means that you're depleted in something, you're dehydrated or you're so sleep deprived that, you know, something may go wrong. And they were right to an extent, but these hallucinations, I had them all the way through. And only in the white navigation light that we had on the boat, never when I used the red head torch. So that's really quite interesting. And in fact, I'm going to meet with someone at the University, Edinburgh University, who's a specialist in sleep and sleep deprivation. Because after the first few days, we were all sleep deprived.
Of course.
We were all in what I call breakdown. And so what happens is that that doesn't go away. You just get used to it. And so in terms of breakdown, it comes in that comes in waves in people. So there's peaks and troughs. And as a crew staying together, you have to negotiate and navigate everyone's breakdowns, including your own, all the way through the journey. So that was one of the most significant parts of this trip for me, was how we all managed managed the breakdowns. And because we're also, you're also in constant pain. All of us were in terrible pain, and you seem to get new pains every day. Different parts of your body would break down as well. So that for me was a huge, huge part of the journey.
And in terms of giving space to each other whilst you process whatever mental angst might be going on, I mean, was it quite sort of demonstrative and loud sometimes and sort of spontaneous, you know, tears or emoting, or it can't have been a quiet experience?
It wasn't loud in that sense. You'd have basically pressure builds up in people, and there's, and you have outbursts, and then, but we were quite good at apologizing and knowing when to apologize and accepting an apology and moving on. That was a huge cathartic feeling for everyone, and it's a thing that I was trying to process the whole experience and the interaction of everyone on board. And the thing that the conclusion I came to was that in any of these group situations, especially when you're under incredible pressure, there's something that you really need. And I'll tell you that word in a second to make things function. But what was interesting for me was there was another couple of guys that we met who were rowing, and they also left from Edinburgh. But I met them afterwards. One of the guys is Jamie's ex-military. And after they had finished as well, we were chatting about the role. And he used to drive boats for the Special Boat Service, very small teams of elite soldiers, sailors, I suppose, with the Navy. But, you know, top military people, personnel. And he said they had two rules on the boat. And one was that if you make a mistake or you're out of order, you apologize. And you also accept the apology from other people and you move on. And the other thing, and this is what really surprised me, and this was the conclusion that I'd come to myself, but I was surprised that they used it in the military, was he said, you need to have kindness. And I just went, oh my God, it's exactly what you need. So in terms of the military saying you need kindness, you need to look after each other. You need to be kind. I thought that was absolutely tremendous. And interestingly, that's the conclusion I came to myself, because there's no place for aggression and anger, because you're so frustrated. That's what naturally comes out. But if you can somehow turn that into kindness for people and forgiveness, then it's a journey for everyone is so much, much better and healthier. And I think people can use that, and not just in crossing the ocean. It's, they can use it in any group dynamic.
Yes, extraordinarily powerful stuff. And the hope is that you've arrived a tighter unit of teamwork makes the dream work. It sounds like you are very close, and it could have gone either way, it would seem.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm very proud that we managed to hold it together when it got incredibly difficult. It's the pressure that it puts on relationships is you can't imagine. That's why some crews end up having fisticuffs. Couples break up. You know what I mean? So it's intolerable, the pressure it puts on people, and the fact that we came through that as friends is a testament to something about us, which is extraordinary. And you know, and we did this together, and nobody can ever take this away from us. We've got this now. And that's a bond that will never break between us.
And the stuff you're describing, you know, as the mental processing, that's nothing you could have prepared for before you suddenly find yourself adrift at sea but rowing.
No, we had two wonderful psychologists who helped us out with many sessions with them. And they gave us a groundwork to work from. So probably without that, who knows? So if anyone is thinking of rowing an ocean, have psychologists, sports psychologists, talk to them about what you need to do to prepare for that and what you need to do to remember when you're out there. Yes. And to have things that you can, places you can go to protect you from, I don't know, the worst excesses of our vulnerabilities.
And at its core, the Talisker Whisky Challenge is a flotilla of vessels, isn't it?
It's Talisker Whisky Atlantic Challenge.
Yeah.
And yes, so every year it varies, but there was 43 boats in the fleet this year. And there's boats, there are boats still out there.
Still doing the trip?
Yeah.
Yes. And presumably it's about finishing. It's not literally about the race. It's just the challenge of getting across, I would say.
Well, our club are very competitive. So we wanted to be competitive. We wanted to do, you know, and doing it as a five is still quite unusual. So there was a chance, you know, if we got the right conditions, we could have set the record for the fives. But quite early on, we had technical difficulties and we lost power three times. So by the end of the first week, we knew we were out of competition. And in terms of morale, certainly for me, I felt completely debilitated by that because I felt as if I'd let a lot of people down. Now remember, I'm already in breakdown, so I'm not thinking straight. But I was overwhelmed by the sense of letting people down. And Shauna and my wife had booked flights to come out and stay with us, expecting us home by a certain date. And now it looked like we weren't going to be in by that date. So I'd messed up that as well. So I'd let down my wife and kids. And it was just quite overwhelming. And in fact, I spoke to Sean after one night shift. And I learned, don't phone home after a night shift. Because you've got the sat phone, you can have a short phone call. And I said, oh, I was so down. And she just said, I love you. And that was me. I was broken. I just couldn't speak. My lip was trembling and I was like all over the place, you know. And she went, Are you okay? You sound like you're drunk. I was like, I'm certainly not drunk. I'm just in bits. So you do go to very dark, lonely places. But what there's a wonderful actor friend of mine, Bertie Porto, who rode the Atlantic in 2011 before it became the Talisker Whisky Atlantic Challenge. And I don't even know what position he came in the race because it never really bothered me because Bertie rode the Atlantic. That's all that matters.
Yes.
And I sort of, it was a little moment of release for me because I went, it doesn't matter about us being competitive. It just matters that we stay together and we finish. And so that's what I've taken from it is that we've rode the Atlantic together. We did it. It doesn't matter where we finished, you know. We didn't get the podium finish. It doesn't matter.
Yes. And that's certainly the external perspective. It's just, you know, everyone I know connected to you and I have felt, you know, from afar, just nothing but immense pride at the fact that you did it. I mean, as you've said, you've done it. There are fewer people than scale Everest that have rode the Atlantic. It is a tremendous triumph.
And hearing that, I mean, and people, there's a woman came up to me and just, I didn't know her in the supermarket the other day saying, oh, we're so proud of you. I don't know you, but I saw you in the news and we're just so proud of you. And then she walked off and I was really touched and moved by that. And hearing how people have been affected is really, you know, it's really moving. I do love it. I didn't realize how much it would affect other people, you know, so that's. And it's a wonderful thing when people express that to us, you know. It makes it all worthwhile. It makes all the pain worthwhile when you know you've affected people in such a positive way.
And I'll just to reiterate the kindness word that you concluded, you know, there is that adage, be kind, be kind, be kind, but most of all, be kind to yourself. And, you know.
Absolutely. Totally, Chris, honestly, because you can give yourself, you're in breakdown. You can give yourself such a hard time, as I did. I gave myself, I was so hard on myself. But I found strength, and I gave myself a good talking to, and I managed to find a way. I empowered myself about three quarters of the way through, because I was up and down, up and down, up and down. And then I just gave myself a good talking to, and I went, right, now you just be present and enjoy it as much as you possibly can.
And it's such a microcosm of life's mental health journey, the idea of it goes in waves. And obviously the Atlantic's going to give and keep giving in the fact that it's rolling in, you know, things change, evolve, different. The hallucinations you're experiencing as well. I mean, it's just such an extraordinary escape you've described.
Well, there was one point where Alec, our skipper, he was trying to film some stuff to send back for social media. And I'd said my name and what I was doing, and we were rowing across for young people's mental health. And then he went, brilliant, okay. And then he paused for a second and he went, oh God, what about our mental health?
Yes.
I mean, both, it was just a moment of, we just laughed and we went, oh my God, I know, we're going insane. We're going nuts here.
And you mentioned laughter there. What were the, there must have been extraordinary releases of, and the relief of laughter as a catharsis as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was always delightful when we found something to laugh at. It was also a lovely moment where, again, Alec and myself, we had a moment, a morning of, probably about an hour or so, of poetry recital. We were just started reciting all the... And that was delightful. So maybe...
Oh, so you went quiet there. You recited what, sorry?
Oh, poetry. We did all the poetry we could remember. So it was like, maybe that's what we needed, was more art. On board to keep ourselves sane, you know. Maybe there's a metaphor in that as well.
And you've done a soundscape yourself of doing some Rabbi Burns poetry. I was reminding myself of the stuff that you've done in your career. You've actually read you've recorded a lot of Rabbi Burns as well.
I have, for the BBC, yes. Indeed, that was a while ago.
So I could just imagine you starting to pontificate the complete works of Shakespeare as you row across.
Yeah.
By the way, when we're going to come on to what I'd like to do is just go into some of the construct, because I think it could be lovely and delicious analogy stuff. So if we can agree that your clearing is the Atlantic, and we've been getting great, this is where we've been rowing across mentally in any case. So you just mentioned about there is Shakespeare in the canopy there. So
Julius Caesar. Should I do it just now?
Yes, please. Do you remember last time we recorded, you came back in to reread the speech that you read at my wedding?
That's right, yeah.
So I keep getting, you know, buy one, get one free. You keep coming back, which is awesome. So, yes, please, to your Julius Caesar.
Well, I suppose this is the but what I take from this piece is that there's no point in putting things off. Now is the time. Just go for it. Which is what I did with this Atlantic challenge, you know, just go for it. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a cruel sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. So that's it.
So just borrowing from the construct of The Good Listening to Stories of Distinction and Genius, this is obviously in spades a story of distinction and genius, just from the very epic quest fact of what you've achieved. So to borrow from some of the construct, we'll talk about shaping, first of all, because it's four things that have shaped you. So how would you describe, and we don't have to make it as linear as this, but how would you say the journey has shaped you now that you've done it?
I feel very humbled. I feel quite emotional saying that. It was so hard, physically and mentally. It was so overwhelmingly difficult. And then coming to conclusion about needing kindness in life and forgiveness. That's really powerful. And I think certainly in being a parent, I feel at the moment more connected to my children. I feel I listen. I'm in a better listening place to them and to, I don't know, people in my life, I guess. So I think that's certainly what it seems to me at the moment. And people, I've done a few interviews and things, and I even did an interview when I was almost arriving into Antigua, and I realized that people were asking me questions, asking me to analyze what I'd been through, and I'm not sure I was ready to analyze it, so I didn't know what was coming out. And I realized, well, you know, the thing is, I'm going to keep analyzing this probably for the rest of my life. So someone asked me a question at one point, it may vary from point to point, but that's my takeaway at the moment from it, is I feel very humbled by it in a good way. I don't mean that in a bad way. And I feel, as I said, in a better listening place to other people's and what they may be experiencing in life.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Lovely answer. And in terms of inspiring you, so how did the Atlantic, how did the journey inspire you, would you say?
Well, what I've just said is inspiring. I don't know, it's just moments like, I don't know about inspiring, but rowing with a full moon at nighttime across the Atlantic and going down that, as I said, that optical illusion of the River of Light and the warm air and rowing in the dark, well, the moonlight with your top off and rowing and realizing that the nearest human habitation is the International Space Station. That's quite an experience, and it makes you feel very, very small, but sort of enormous at the same time. So part of everything round about you, that I don't know what inspires me to do, but it certainly.
By the way, that was such a lovely answer, because that was about awe-inspiring. The whole thing has been awe-inspiring.
Yeah. Okay. Awe-inspiring. I was certainly, yes, that's how you describe it.
In terms of star constellations, was there a particular guiding star that you related to?
Oh, I was totally taken by Orion. I hadn't seen Orion and all his glory. I don't know their glory, but the stars. Ed taught us how to always find the North Star, for instance, and just the breadth of stars was just incredible. And also, quite early on, and it was down by the horizon on the port side, and so we were talking east, and it was just right on the horizon, there's this flash of light, explosion of light, and I went, what was that? And Alex said, oh, it's a moon flash. And I went, what is that? He went, well, just watch. And then, so there'd be this flash of light and then nothing. And then suddenly the clouds sort of parted and the moon appeared and then started to rise. And it was just phenomenal, incredible. And I didn't see it again. We saw lots of shooting stars. You don't really get blasé about them, though. We saw lots of them. And they were really clear. And they went on for quite a while, some of them. And then one night, again, it wasn't a moon flash, but we saw, it was quite high up, so it was nowhere near clouds or anything. Just this explosion of light. We were rowing at night, and there's this huge explosion, and we're like, what was that? And then you sort of go, wait a minute, we're not in contact with it. It could be a third world war. We wouldn't know anything about it, you know. We're in the middle of nowhere. But so, yeah, you see phenomena like that in the night sky, and it's yeah, as you say, awe-inspiring. It's just incredible. And, you know, bioluminescence across the ocean. That's quite incredible as well, you know.
By the way, what's really profound is your own relationship to Orion's Belt. That's so relatable to me because the middle star in Orion's Belt is my navigation point to my sister's death. The day she was killed, I went outside and the star was that third, the middle star of Orion's Belt. So wherever I have been historically since 1979, whenever I see Orion's Belt, the middle star is always winking at me, and that's Hazel. So that's incredibly relatable.
Yeah.
You love absolutely. That constellation more than any others.
Ah, oh, great. Yeah, so no, I was just struck by that. In fact, someone offered to tattoo it for me on my body somewhere, so I'm going to go for that.
Wonderful. And so in the construct now, it's two things that never fail to grab your attention, which in the construct normally is, oh, squirrels, but there aren't many squirrels unless you're hallucinating at sea. You have described flying fish, but mid-row, everything you've described, mid-turbulence, mid-joy, mid all the gamut of human emotions, what would never fail to grab your attention, even if it's the shooting stars or Orion's Belt? What things never fail
to grab your attention? Well, I haven't told you about my hallucinations. Certainly one of them would be my hallucinations. So they were people on board the boat with me. First of all, the first one I saw was my wife on the aft cabin. I saw this figure and I went, oh, Shauna, Shauna's here. Great. And then the next night it was, and the weird thing is my brain knew it was like the flagpole and the flags. It was something hanging off the side of the boat. My brain knew it was something physical that I was seeing as this vision, but the visions were really clear. So the next night there was a woman standing, and I was going, I know it's the flags, but there was a woman standing on the aft cabin facing east this time. And she looked like a woman from like the clearances in Scotland of sort of period. So she's got a shawl on her shoulders and a scarf on her head. And she was dressed in period clothes, just gazing out east. And there was other characters. There was three people appeared right beside Alec, our skipper, when he was rowing, and we had music playing one night. We had music playing a few nights, but the speakers broke, so we didn't have any music for most of the time. And they were sort of bopping along to the music. But they were real faces, real people. Not that anybody I recognised. And then there was a very powerful looking black African woman who was on port side looking west. And at that point I was thinking, am I in the sixth sense? Am I actually seeing dead people on board boat? They're so clearly people. And my brain's going, no, it's just a hallucination. I know it's a hallucination, but that's so clear. She's looking out. Why is she gazing west like that? And eventually I'd see lots of people. Some were like grotesque puppets, faces, demon faces. But they weren't as interesting as the actual real people faces that I saw. And then eventually I was rowing, and there was this young woman came up at speed beside me, and then turned around and looked me straight in the face, and I got a fright. and then I got angry. I went, right, that's it, no more, you can all just fuck off. I'm not gonna, you know. And I didn't see any hallucinations for a few nights after that, but as long as my brain just shut down, that I couldn't take it anymore. But
was it typically in the dead of night, or was it any time of day this could
happen? No, it was always nighttime. Always nighttime in the navigation. The white, I would call it the ghostly light of the navigation light, and never the red head torch light. So that's quite interesting in itself. The brain, whatever brain chemistry was going on, you know. So it's sleep deprived. I don't think I was so dehydrated, and I was still eating. So I imagine it's just sleep deprivation,
coupled with a heightened sense of presence, I would say, because it's just so unique to find yourself in that seascape. I mean, the Atlantic is providing such a beautiful storyscape in what you're describing here. Mm-hmm. It's really. And what about fear? Did you ever feel scared if there are storms kicking up? Or
You know what? We didn't really feel scared. When we lost power, we had to row at nighttime in the dark without the navigation light, without the AIS system, which means that you can see other boats and they can see you. So no one could see us. And also, I didn't hand steer. I was always rowing, but a couple of the guys had to take turns hand steering and following a compass, which is furious concentration. And doing it at nighttime is so hard because you try not to fall asleep and you're trying to keep it on course. And hand steering is very easy to overcompensate. And then you have to pull it back again. And before you know it, the boat's all over the place, you know. Really, really hard stuff to do. So that was concerning, the fact no one could see us. But I wouldn't really say it was fear. We were quite lucky in that sense. And we trusted the boat. There were some very, very big waves, but we never really felt threatened. And Alec and Ed kept us going south as much as possible to avoid the beam-on winds that might tip us over. And when we heard that one of the American boats had been tipped over and they had to be rescued, we presumed that's what had happened to them. It turned out it wasn't. It was more technical problems. But when you hear that one of the boats has been tipped over and they had to take to the life raft and rescued by a tanker or a container ship or something, then you sort of go, right, well, maybe we were right to keep going south and avoid these winds, you know. But I don't think we experienced much fear. We didn't see any sharks. So when we had to get in the water, I didn't get in the water, but a couple of guys got in the water to clean the hull. Because we hadn't seen the sharks, we didn't really have that sense of sharks around about us. So we didn't even have that fear of getting in the water, you know. But I think if we'd seen a shark, then absolutely we would have been very aware. But it almost was like, you know, are there any big fish in the sea? We haven't seen any, you know. But we saw again, a marlin briefly, but that was it.
Okay, and I'm so full of admiration because just the sheer scale and epicness of it and the how far away you were from what was familiar to you, I think I felt scared for you a few times. And I know when I spoke to Shauna, you'd only just got going and she was having to handle Christmas and New Year, knowing that your beloved husband is just out in the big expanse. Yeah. I felt scared for you after I'd spoken.
I can understand that. Because when you're not doing it, you have no power over it. So I can understand why there is fear for other people because you can't affect it in any way. But we were there and having to get up and row is so all consuming. So you're either physically rowing or you're trying to wash yourself or eat some food and get some precious sleep. There wasn't a lot of time to be afraid, you know. You just have to go on and do the work. That's what it was like.
It is keep on keeping on. You know that adage, which is keep on keeping on. Just keep moving.
That's like what you've got to do. The only way to get through this is to keep doing it. Keep doing it. Keep doing it, you know. And the pains we had, you know, the pain in my bum was just unbelievable. And you've got to sit in it every day. And it was 3 weeks before I took any painkillers. And then I was like knocking them back like crazy. And but also your hands blister, your feet blister. The oars smack off your shins. They get caught in the waves and they smack off your shins. You know, it's like, I think it used to be a torture by some people. They used to smack people's shins with bamboo poles. That's what it's like. And the pains. In fact, yesterday I caught my shin, so it's still very delicate. And the pain because of that sort of the nerves running down the shin or thereabouts, it goes right through your body. And it's very painful when your knees are all cut and scraped and your shins bruised. And that's just some of the pain. One of the guys, he got his feet got infected and his knee swelled up and he couldn't kneel. It was now he couldn't row for 2 days. Another woman from another boat, she fell and hit her face first off the deck and she had a massive swelling coming out of her head. And, you know, so there's pain. You're living with pain constantly, but... Yes. Here's the thing, and something I realized in the boat, we knew it was going to end once we got to the other end, once we got to the other side. We knew it would stop. Just get there, fight through the pain, get there, it will stop. And I had a whole new respect for people who have chronic pain and can't see a way out of it. My mother-in-law, for instance, had she just died last year. She was an incredible woman. And she lived in discomfort, if not pain, for most, a lot of her life. And so I really became very aware of people who cannot see the ending and just have to constantly live for that and find a way to be through that pain, because we had a way out. But it was most uncomfortable.
It's such a wonderful analogy about just the journeymaning through life on this journey, because it is a just keep on keeping on. There are so many analogies about just the journey of life, and it's not over until it's over, and keep going, it will come to an end. I mean, it's just people will want to speak to you for years on end, I'm sure, about the sort of seismic learning that one can glean from somebody who's done it. It's an epic quest of an extraordinary nature.
But there was some. Just this morning, I read about a couple of guys, New Zealand guys, and they were saying they finished the row, and they were saying, we loved every minute of it. And I was a little bit jealous of that. I was like, oh my God. But I don't know whose journey is going to be more valuable in life. Somebody who really suffered through the journey, or someone who thought it was just brilliant. I don't know.
I'm with the suffering. I think crafting. I think you learn more. Pain, out of adversity comes great creativity. No pain, no gain. All the other adages. I think they're probably lying.
Yeah, could be.
So, Cal, as this has been your moment in the sunshine of the good listening to, as you row across the Atlantic, I'm going to ramp up to, is there anything else you want to say? But I'm just going to pull out a bit of a comedy prop behind me. This is called the passing the golden baton moment. Way! So it's a golden relay baton. Who do you think would most appreciate, within the journeymaning of what you've just done, who would most appreciate a good listening to in passing the baton on to them?
I think my friend Tony Curran would love to go on the journey with you. We were fortunate to, there was when I was away, there was a BBC TV show called Mayflies, which Sean and I were both in, but the two leads were Tony Curran and Martin Compston. And if you haven't seen it yet, Mayflies is on BBC iPlayer, and you'll need a box of tissues, because it's very, very moving. But it's almost like Tony, it was almost like the part was created for Tony. It was just perfect role, and it was great to see a brilliant actor friend of yours getting this role that's so rich and gets them a chance to show off everything they've learned about their craft. And that's what it felt like with Tony. And he would love this journey.
And I'm very humbled myself by that recommendation, because he's someone like you that I very much rate and respect. And Mayflies is one of those things I'm yet to watch, but no, it's brilliant, because I was even moved in watching the micro clips of it as well. So I know the basic premise of it. So thank you for that, Cal. So that is passing the golden baton, please. And your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to furnish a sort of warm introduction clang in the background. And now, as this has been your moment, and thank you so much for taking a second row pass through the clearing. That was such a rich conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
No, just thank you, really. It's always lovely talking to you, and it was lovely the first time, and this time was fabulous. I loved it.
Me too. And if you have obviously been listening here on Facebook or on Buzzsprout, Cal was in the clearing about a year and a half ago, and thank you for saying yes then. But since then, of course, you've just overcome the most extraordinary epic quest, and I have nothing but love, admiration and respect for you. And thank you for sharing. I mean, that was so insightful, some of the stuff that you've just shared.
Pleasure.
Rich listening indeed. And so you've been listening to Cal McEnany. This has been Stories of Distinction and Genius, and in a nutshell, that is it's extraordinary. And I look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you very much indeed, and good night. You've been listening to The Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.